House Committee on Revenue for May 1st, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, my plan is to take these public hearings in order, so we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3085. Dave, do you want to tell us a little about the bill?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3085 established the Healthcare Professional Training Fund using the assessment on health insurance plans. And the purpose is to use the fund to help communities addressing their unmet healthcare professional workforce needs.
Very good. Senator, thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I assume you're going to say a little more about this bill.
Yes, sir, if I may. Thank you very much. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner, Hayward State Senate District 17. And I am grateful to the committee for your hearing, House Bill 3085. One of the challenges in bending the cost curve is making sure we have enough healthcare professionals of all types, not just physicians, but social workers and licensed professional counselors and dentists and pharmacists and all the people who really provide the frontline services that every Oregonian needs at one point or another in his or her life. And we know that access to these services helps decrease costs by focusing on prevention and early intervention. However, we don't have enough of these people, and there are many studies that support that. And we also know that setting up training programs can be expensive. We also know that people tend to practice and work within 50 miles of where they train. So the more of these training programs that we can set up in Oregon, the more likely we are to have these health professionals live, work, provide services in our state for the people who need them. And in particular, this is true for parts of our state that are historically underserved. I'm thinking of our more rural parts of our communities, where we have the resources available to provide the training that people would need. Especially when communities work together to develop the resources, we just don't have the money to get the program started. So, for example, given how oddly graduate medical education is funded, St. Charles Medical Center, which would like to set up a family medicine residency, which would like to host two child psychiatry residents, and you'll see testimony in the record from Dr. Ajit Jetmalani at OHSU about this issue. They can't do that because the federal government says they aren't allowed to have more than one resident at a time based on some weird, archaic Byzantine rules about how graduate medical education is funded. We could develop a healthcare workforce training fund to help start up the startup costs and some low ongoing costs and match it with community input, then we would be able to start that program. Eastern Oregon is very interested in setting up some mental health training programs. Eastern Oregon University, Blue Mountain Community College, Treasure Valley together, several cities out there, they're interested in doing this. But that takes work, and it takes money, and it takes time. They're willing to put in the work, they're willing to put in the time, they're willing to put in their share of the resources, but they can't do it all by themselves. What this bill would do is put an assessment of a penny per member per day on all of our commercial insurers, all of our TPAs, third-party administrators for self-insured companies, and all of our CCOs. The net of that would be about $22 million a biennium. That would go into the Healthcare Workforce Training Fund that would be administered by the Oregon Health Policy Board. They would set up a grant program or a loan program or both that they would then administer based on recommendations of their workforce committee or other appropriate entities that show where the need is for what kinds of health professionals around our state. Communities would then be required to put in proposals. They would have to have skin in the game. The idea is not to just give them this money freely. They have to be sure that they're going to be investing resources as well to set up programs that would provide the training for the healthcare professionals that we need across our state. Many states have done similar things, often funded by insurance companies. New York is a good example. Several other states have done that. And that's where I got some of these ideas. And it's to their benefit, right? Insurance companies have to have network adequacy. They have to have enough providers available to see their members so that people can get the preventive care or early intervention care that they need. I would say this. This may be a tough year to get the fiscal part of this, the assessment part of this bill through. We are already looking to our insurers and our CCOs to help meet our need for Medicaid in this state, and they have stepped up to the plate and been very collaborative, and I want to thank them publicly for their willingness to do that. You'll be hearing more about that soon on this committee, I am sure. And I would thank them for their general support of the idea when we heard this in House Health, as Representative Nose can attest, for the idea of this. I will be working on an amendment for this bill to actually strip out the assessment for now, but set up the training fund and allow the opportunity for outside funders to come in or for other ways to fund it. But I'd like to get the mechanism in place so that we can start to develop what those grant structures and program rules might be, so that when we are able to fund this program in one way or another, we have the structure in place to do so and don't have to delay any further. So as you hear testimony from others, know that I am committed to this concept. Many of us are committed to this concept. Whether we can get it funded this year or not, I want to pass this bill, and I hope that you'll support my doing so. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the good Senator. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much for being here. I just have a question about the budget. I understand you're stripping out the assessments out of the bill. But the assessments, when there, you said, I think, would raise $22 million a biennium. Is that correct? Is that what it takes? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, that's a great question. The reality is the need is almost infinite. That money, it takes about $3 to $4 million investment and 2 to 3 years to set up a medical residency program, the ones that family physicians or pediatricians or psychiatrists go to. I don't know, because I don't have as much experience with it, how long it takes to set up a social work program, but my guess it's several years as well. I think that this money will provide a substantial chunk toward this problem, but whether it's sufficient, I don't know if I can tell you the answer to that question. I think we'd know a lot more as it moves forward. But getting it in place would provide money that we don't currently have on the table and that other states have to help fund these kinds of programs.
Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Senator, for being here. Important concept. Can you tell me a little bit about what stakeholder input you may have had on this? Have you had a chance to sit in with insurers? I would guess other perhaps existing entities within the education world to see what other programs there might be that you could build on rather than just having to, you know, start from the ground up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I appreciate that. I have had many conversations with colleagues in the insurance industry who, as I said, are generally supportive of the concept. This year probably isn't the right year to ask them for more money, and I get that. We've had lots of conversations. There's something called the Graduate Medical Education Consortium that was set up based on a bill that this body passed in 2011. That I was involved in before I came to the legislature, to set up that consortium to do planning for our need for increased graduate medical education around the state. There are grants that are available from other organizations. I believe the bill already has an allowance for other funds to be used, but if it doesn't, that was one of the things I planned to put in with the amendment, because I do think that we have to look at leveraging, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't think that this should be solely funded by the insurers. That's why I said communities have to have skin in the game too. And they could do that by procuring grants from entities that do support the startup of educational programs. Mm-hmm. The idea is that ultimately most of these programs would be self-sustaining. From the programs where learners can bill for their services, that would help sustain the programs like medical residencies. For others, it would be sustained by tuition and other kinds of appropriations that are sent. The intent is not to have this be on an ongoing basis. The other point that I would make, Representative, is that one of the biggest challenges we have with training healthcare professionals is sufficient clinical placements for during their training. And one of the reasons we have trouble with that is because it can be hard to ask a busy practitioner of any kind, a pharmacist, a nurse practitioner, a PA, a doctor, a social worker, a psychologist, to take on a learner to commit time that could otherwise be used to see patients and serve their patients and then not be able to do that work. But they want to teach. So one of the things that this could be used for would be stipends for clinical preceptors, and that's particularly important in our rural areas. And those could be ongoing funds, but that would be an appropriate use for them, I think, on an ongoing basis.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the focus on the medically underserved areas. I didn't understand, and perhaps you can clarify the line 13, ensuring that individuals enrolled in healthcare professional training programs are adequately compensated. What was the thinking there?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Benz, thank you for the question. The concern is that sometimes healthcare professionals who are in their training don't actually get paid very much. And with the rising cost of living and with salaries not going up for trainees such as medical residents, to make sure that especially if they're living in areas, I mean, if you think about Central Oregon, the cost of living there is not exactly trivial these days. And we want to be sure that residency programs and other programs where learners are paid part of time have the funds necessary to do it. But the focus primarily is on the startup costs for these programs and for ensuring that faculty are well paid. I would point out also that faculty compensation is dramatically lower than what you get when you're in private practice in almost any of these specialties. I personally took a 40% pay cut when I went from private practice to being on faculty at OHSU, and it took me 20 years to 15 years to make that back. And really basically haven't. It was worth it to me because I thought it was important to teach the next generation of Oregon physicians, and I think a lot of people choose to make that sacrifice, but I don't think people should have to make that sacrifice. People should be compensated for teaching the next generation of healthcare providers in this state.
Not so much a follow-up as a, but I do have another question. The I know you're taking the funding piece out, but What was your thinking on targeting just healthcare as opposed to general fund for this? What's the rationale for limiting those who pay to just those who have health insurance?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Benz, another good question as usual. The thought was twofold. First of all, actually, the state currently does fund graduate medical education through the Medicaid program to the tune of $21 million a biennium. I'm not sure we're going to be able to continue that in the upcoming biennium, given our fiscal situation. But we do it because we believe it's important to make sure we have an adequate health professional setting to serve Oregonians, particularly those served by Medicaid, which is approximately 1 in 4 Oregonians at this point. The rationale for targeting the insurance companies and the CCOs is because they're the ones who need the providers. Every Oregonian does. But asking them to pay $3.65 per member per year seemed like a relatively small price to pay to ensure the adequacy of the workforce here. I think that every Oregonian does benefit from having an adequate healthcare workforce supply, and one could look at funding it further through general fund. But the reality is that first and foremost, we keep our premiums down, we keep insurance companies whole by ensuring that we have the right kinds of healthcare workforce and that Oregonians have access to the right kinds of healthcare providers in a timely and geographically proximate fashion.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, it's good seeing you.
Good to see you.
Colleagues, I would share with you, I've had a chance to work with the senator for a number of years, and she is extraordinarily thoughtful in her approach. Healthcare professional, is there some type of definition for that? I'm thinking in my district, it's pharmacists, mm-hmm. where we have a
Absolutely.
Tremendous demand. But in other parts of the state, it may be different. Help me understand what the definition of a healthcare professional is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. Thank you very much for your kind comments as well. We kept the definition pretty broad, and in general, we're thinking about it in the sense of what we would call critical access specialties or critical access healthcare professionals, the people you don't want to have to drive more than 50 miles to see. In 2007, I had the privilege of serving on a work group chaired by Senator Bates, where we were revamping the malpractice premium subsidy for rural providers, and we sort of came up with that definition of critical access. Now, that was focused on physicians and nurse practitioners primarily, but the general concept is it's the people you don't want to have to drive more than 50 miles to see. So it would certainly include pharmacists. It would include social workers or licensed professional counselors. It would include dentists and expanded permit dental hygienists. It would include a wide range of healthcare providers who serve the needs of Oregonians day in and day out, and the people that we have to count on for the frontline care. And one of the reasons that we left it to the discretion of the Health Policy Board was for exactly the reason you pointed out. Different parts of the state need different kinds of providers at different times, and one has to prioritize. How long does it take to train certain kinds of providers, right? And you have to think about, what does our need look like? How long will it take us to build that pipeline and get people out the other end to serve Oregonians? And so the Health Policy Board was seen as a good, fair broker of this. They already have the Workforce Committee doing really significant work, and they know how to use the resources that are out there to gain the information to balance all those competing needs.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'd just share with you, in District 57, I represent some of the smallest, most remote frontier counties where the issues that this bill's trying to address would benefit significantly. And so I compliment the carrier on this. I also compliment, from a Ways and Means perspective, the fact that there's language in here that talks about that the Healthcare Professional Training Fund continues to perpetuate itself and doesn't just divert right back to the general fund. I think that's how you grow a fund and have it into, you know, perpetuity into the future. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? I would simply note in response to Representative Marsh's question that I was on one of the Ways and Means subcommittees in 2007. We considered a request by Oregon Health and Sciences University to open a residency training program in Eugene. And his estimate of the cost of doing that, I think for 3 years, was $7.5 million.
Wow.
That means that the number you're proposing is about right for a very small startup program. $3 million plus, I think, was the number that you were talking about. And recognizing, of course, that costs have gone up since then as well. So,
In District 57, Mr. Chair, we really struggle with professional pharmacists.
Yeah.
It's nearly impossible to get that service. But for one family who's chosen to make it a lifestyle for them, there would be no pharmaceutical service within a block of, I'm going to guess, 150 plus miles.
Mr. Chair, one more comment, if I might. I've had the privilege of working closely with a wide range of people in this building on healthcare provider incentives since before I came in. In fact, that bill that I referenced in 2011 was one of many that I worked on before I came to the legislature. I have been working this session closely with Representative Nathanson, who's got a bill, the number of which escapes me, but it's down in Ways and Means. And I've worked in the past with her on several bills around healthcare professional incentives, which is the other side of this coin. We know that healthcare professional training is expensive. We know that most people coming out of medical school, dental school, pharmacy school, social work, psychology, have significant debt after they come out, which may limit their ability to practice in certain areas or choose certain specialties or certain kinds of practices that this state needs. Ultimately, the intention had been, were we able, in fact, to fund this year, to merge our two bills together, because we would then have increased the assessment to 2 pennies per member per day, with the intent of being able to fund in perpetuity the health care provider incentives that we struggle to refund to fund every biennium. I've been part of those conversations since 2003, in every long session. And again, as Representative Smith kindly pointed out, we're trying to figure out a way that we don't have to have this conversation every biennium, both for the workforce training and for the provider incentives. There's a Lewin report study that demonstrates the value of these healthcare provider incentives and the importance of providing them to ensure that our rural and urban underserved areas have an adequate healthcare workforce. We know that healthcare providers in their community generate significant economic impact too. So I know this committee will be very thoughtful about this. I will be working on the amendment. I very much appreciate your thoughtful questions today, and I beg your forgiveness for not staying for the rest of the hearing, but I'm supposed to be testifying in Representative Holvey's committee right this minute as well.
All right. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
May we excuse Senator Sterner Hayward? Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Sorry.
Let me just pile on,
please.
Chair, if I may, for a second. And I appreciate Senator Steiner Hayward's work on this topic for many years, and eventually I suspect we'll get something positive accomplished. There's a lot of big benefits from training programs, and she touched on a few of them, but I just want to underline the economic development, the leverage here from one training program in a residency produces 5 or 6 jobs. Mm. And the other thing is studies are really conclusive that if you train in an area, a rural area, people are more likely to stay there, up to about 70% more likely to stay in the location where they train for their residency. So it's a great way to get people into some of these underserved areas. And then the cash flow issue of this, it's really about the startup costs. Because the startup costs, as Chair Barnhart talked about, are high. But then they start to capitalize themselves from payments over time, because as providers get farther along in their training program, they start filling their clinics and generating revenue that then continues to fund the programs.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate
Thank
your
you very
testimony
much. Appreciate
today.
All the good, great questions from the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a number of other witnesses who want to be heard on this bill, but I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3085 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3041. So that we can hear from a representative who's also has other places to be. Chris, do you want to tell us a little about this bill?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just very quickly, this increases, House Bill 3041 increases the crop donation credit from 15% of the wholesale price of the donation of the crops to 25%.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, Bence and Smith Warner, and members of the committee. I'm Mike McLean. I represent District 55 in the legislature. In 2014, Senate Bill 1541 reinstated the Oregon Crop Donation Tax Credit, passed the House and the Senate unanimously. We are in a booming economy. Nevertheless, food insecurity continues to plague Oregonians. 270,000 disadvantaged Oregonians rely on emergency food sources like the Oregon Food Bank on a monthly basis. House Bill 3041 would increase the tax credit from 15 to 25% of the value of crops donated to Oregon food banks, resulting in more incentive to donate. More importantly, this extra incentive is designed to offset the cost of the growing and packaging of donated produce. I live in Cook County, which was decimated in the Great Recession, skyrocketing rates of food insecurity, unemployment, and folks who had never relied on the food bank did. And we have been blessed more than we can express by innovative entrepreneurs and government officials like yourself, Mr. Chair, who helped a infant industry data centers locate in Prineville. As a result, our unemployment rate is way down and good jobs are up, which tells you there is a direct connection between reliance on food banks and the economy, period. My home county is doing a lot better today because of your work. That said, we still need reliance. I have apprehension that any downturn in the economy will lead to Oregon Food Bank reliance jumping considerably. This is a small way in which we can offset those costs. From all evidence that I have been showing from the food bank and elsewhere, the extra 10% of a would increase the donations, because it will offset the costs of transporting produce and packaging produce so that it can lawfully be distributed in the food bank. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative McLean? On to your next committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we will temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3041 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3085. We have at least a couple of panels of people who want to be heard. Brian Eichmann, Catherine Cushing, Morgan, it looks like Flork. Would those three people come on up, please? And I apologize if I have butchered your name. If you would state your name for the record and then give your testimony, it would be helpful. I have four more people to be heard on this bill and two other bills to be heard, so brevity is of high value. But we want to hear what you have to say as well.
Great. Well, maybe I'll just jump in. My name is Catherine Cushing, for the record. I'm the executive director of the Oregon GME Consortium, which the senator just referred to. And we do have some wonderful folks giving testimony today. I don't want to be terribly repetitive. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I think you've heard that there is a tremendous shortage of healthcare professionals in our state, especially in rural and underserved areas. And we need to do everything we can to figure out how to fix that. And this bill is one good step in the right direction. There are many studies, and in my testimony online, you can check those studies out if you want to have more information about the shortage. The Oregon GME Consortium is addressing the shortage of primary care physicians specifically in our state by providing assistance and resources to hospitals and clinics to establish primary care residencies outside of the Portland metro area. Developing these programs, however, is incredibly expensive and requires a great deal of capacity and commitment from the hospitals and clinics, physicians, communities, students who are actually trying to carry this out. Hospitals in the consortium are using consortium grant money and their own resources to begin developing new programs. Ongoing funding is a problem, though, and while hospitals are very willing to shoulder their part of the burden, as are students, as are medical schools, they really can't shoulder the whole thing alone. House Bill 3085 would assist hospitals and other training institutions in making sure Oregonians are able to receive timely and appropriate care where and when they need it. It would help to share the burden among all interested stakeholders in this issue. So thank you very much. I'm more than willing to answer questions or to cede the floor to my fellows here.
Thank you very much. Who would like to go next?
I'll go next. My name is Brian Eichmann. I'm from Roseburg, Oregon, with Mercy Medical Center. I'm the operations director for Centennial Medical Group. Centennial Medical Group is a division of Mercy with over 60 employed physicians and the largest primary care clinic in Douglas County. I've been in healthcare for over 18 years and lived in Roseburg for over 25 years. There's not enough physicians in rural Oregon. Our ability to recruit and retain these physicians directly impacts the health of the communities. It directly impacts the viability of the hospital and directly impacts the medical community. It also impacts our economic ability within those communities. It's very difficult and expensive to recruit physicians. I'm very active in the process. It takes a team and a lot of man hours to recruit physicians to our areas. We pay thousands of dollars to headhunters to find candidates, fly them in from New York and Florida and Texas, set them up, make offers for compensation that are far exceed market from urban areas, thousands of dollars in sign-on bonuses, thousands of dollars in retaining fees just to find out they took an offer in Tacoma, Washington, then to start the process all over again. That's why Mercy Medical Center decided that we wanted to start a family medicine residency program. I've been the project manager on that for over 4 years. I've been, from the beginning, part of the GME consortium. We're further along now than we've ever been as a result of the generous grant process that we received through the GME consortium to help us with the startup. But the ability for us to get this off the ground is still at risk. Our expert estimates that this is going to cost us $1.1 million per year to train 8 physicians to practice in rural Oregon. I'd say that again. It's going to be $1.1 million per year to train 8 physicians to practice in rural Oregon. That doesn't include the over $3 million for the startup fee. to get us even going from there. So this program without the funding is definitely at risk. If we don't find additional funding, this may not go. But we are this close to getting this off the ground. We're more than willing and understand that we have to fund this as well and are willing to do that. But this bill may be that last piece that with the funding that comes to us to make this thing a go. And that's kind of what I wanted to share with you guys today.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and the rest of the committee. My name is Morgan Florick, and I am a second-year medical student at Western University of Health Sciences College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest in Lebanon, Oregon, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3085. I was born and raised in Lebanon, Oregon, and I have been a firsthand witness to the unmet needs of rural areas in Oregon. I've seen this as a member of the community, as an in-home caregiver in Linn County, and now as a medical student. And I can tell you that I am dedicated to working and serving in rural Oregon, and that I am not alone in this. I belong to the Rural Health Track at Comp Northwest, and what this is a track that prepares students for work in rural areas and provides us with experiences we need to be prepared for that type of work. And I'm in this track along with 40 other students. 18 of these students are currently actively engaged in the community, working with local healthcare and also with local patients in order to try and change healthcare delivery from more volume-based to more value-based. They're doing this by identifying challenges and breaking through barriers by developing safety and quality initiatives. So they're already out there working in these areas, and they know that they want to be there. And this is not just limited to the students in this rural health track. Many of the students at my school and in my class want to stay in Oregon, and we don't want to lose these students to other states. But the disappointing reality is there's an exportation of physicians to other states because we don't have enough residency programs here. There's more students graduating than there are residency programs. And despite being a strong student, I worry that I won't get a residency spot in Oregon. And even if I am lucky to get a spot here, we'll most likely be in an urban area and not in one of these rural areas that really need physicians. And bringing residencies to Oregon will help keep doctors here. According to the American Association of Medical Colleges, 63% of recent Oregon residents stayed in Oregon. And we not only need more residents, we need a wider geographic distribution of these residents. There's about 3,000 doctors who recently completed their medical education and now practice in Oregon, but only 15% of them are actually serving in federally designated medically underserved areas. We need to bring more residencies to Oregon so that we can provide opportunities for doctors to invest in communities here and continue building relationships with communities that they want to be in. And I understand that building and maintaining residency programs are expensive. However, this bill will help spread the burden of that cost across many organizations and will help hospitals and clinics develop these residency programs so that they can not only train physicians but retain these physicians in those communities. I decided to pursue medicine because I am strongly dedicated to serving my community and want to provide the best care that I can. So please support the House Bill 3085 so that we can continue adding healthcare professionals to Oregon and work together to bring the care here that we need. Thank you
very much. Questions for this panel? I would simply note that I had the great pleasure of visiting Western University along with several other members, I think last year, if I remember correctly. It's quite a facility. Mm-hmm. Good luck in your program. And thank you as well for coming today. Ryan Emery, Robin DeBelbus, Doug Barber, please. We might as well continue with Western University.
All right. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and the rest of the committee. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. My name is Ryan Emery. I'm a first-year medical student at Comp Northwest, and I was born and raised in rural Southern Oregon. So I, too, can speak firsthand to the challenges and the unmet needs of accessing health care in a rural area in Oregon. As I see it, this bill is underlying it a access to health care bill, improving the access for all of Oregonians, but especially those in rural areas. And as I can describe, it is a very difficult challenge accessing a physician, accessing health care professionals in these rural areas. And these physicians not only provide that source of health care, but they also provide leadership in communities. And I can tell you again that that is something that's also lacking in rural Oregon. And us physicians, or physicians-to-be, are tremendous and willing leaders of these communities. We serve our communities, and we look to do that. Now, for me, I want to impress upon you a couple of the considerations I have as a medical student entering my medical career. Primarily, it is the debt load I'm going to face when I come out. I'm going to face about $500,000 when I graduate from 4 years of medical school. And underlying that is, where will I have a job? And that first place that's going to give me a job is going to get me. And right now we have a huge disparity in the number of graduates, medical school graduates here in Oregon, and the residencies for which they can apply to and fill. So we're losing our medical school graduates and our graduates from all of our other health professions. I want to stay here in Oregon, but a lot of that is dependent on whether or not I can have a job here. In fact, suggests that I'm much more likely to stay and develop my roots and family wherever I train. So I hope that in the coming years, you can help us develop the positions and the jobs we need to retain physicians here and improve the access to health care for all of our Oregonian citizens and our Oregon communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. Chairman Barnhart and the rest of the committee, my name is Robin Drybelbus, and I'm a family physician, and I have the distinct honor of teaching these two young medical students over the last couple of years. I serve as an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine for Comp Northwest. And as you know, collectively in the state, we have two medical schools, Comp Northwest in Lebanon, Oregon, and OHSU. And together, we graduate on the numbers of between 240 and 250 new graduates every single year that want to go on to the next phase of their training. The next phase of their training is often called, well, it is called graduate medical education, often referred to as GME or residency. In this country, that next phase of their training, there's a huge disparity between the number of people applying for those first-year slots and the number of people that actually get those first-year slots. So this year, just last month, actually in March, there was something called the National Residency Matching Program, often called the MATCH, that happens every single year where new graduates open up the envelope to find out where they're going to go to residency and finish out their training. This year, there were 35,969 slots available for new graduates, and only 35,969 applicants for 31,757 slots, which means there's a deficit of over 4,000 graduates that did not get a residency training program. Can you imagine graduating with $500,000 worth of debt and not getting a training program? Well, this body, the Oregon Legislature, saw that as a huge opportunity to train people in the state a couple of years ago and developed the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee to look at the opportunity to create novel ways to train and retain physicians for this state. Now, I'm a family physician, and I know this bill covers a wide swath of healthcare training. I'm speaking just on GME when I say this. and that they wanted to not only create residency slots, but create them in the medically underserved areas. Now, what we know to be true is that the numbers say that right now, based on 2015 data, the disparity in one primary care physician for a populace in a county ranges from one physician, one PCP, to 491 people in a particular county, all the way up to one PCP to almost 3,000 people in a county. That's a huge disparity. And so we have multiple training sites and programs within this state already. Are they adequate? Probably not, based on the numbers that we currently know. But what we know to be true is they all live up and down the I-5 corridor. What we need is residency training programs outside of the I-5 corridor. This bill, House Bill 3085, would be an opportunity for those communities and healthcare systems who want to begin a GME program to recruit and retain physicians in that county and community to do that by decreasing that initial burden of cost that is posed when a community wants to begin a GME program. So I stand in support of 3085, and I stand behind Comp Northwest's mission, which is to train physicians from the Northwest, in the Northwest, for the Northwest. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Doug?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. We represent more than 1,400 family physicians throughout the state of Oregon, and we're here today in support of increased funding for healthcare workforce training programs. Oregon is blessed to have a couple of the best family medicine training programs in the country at OHSU and now at Comp Northwest. Unfortunately, as you've heard, those young graduates are in the position of having to go out of state for their residency programs, which means that rural communities and rural medical practices have to then try to lure those doctors to come back after their residencies. And as others have mentioned, all of the literature will tell you that where physicians do their training is where they are most likely to start their practice. We have a couple of rural family medicine residency programs in Oregon, one in Hood River, another one in Klamath Falls. They're both great. They're just not big enough. There's just not enough slots there. So we support the funding for residency programs for physicians, but as you know, doctors don't practice in isolation, especially as they create patient-centered primary care homes. We need more nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and especially behavioral health providers in order to provide the kind of wraparound services that patients are now demanding. And this program, this bill, would provide the kind of training and funding that we need for all of those disciplines, and we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I have a couple. What's the staff needed to run this kind of a residency program? What do you need to have in order to do it? In addition to the new graduate doctor.
That is a hard question to answer because it varies, I would say. You have to look at the faculty development that has to happen, the support of the faculty and all of that infrastructure that occurs. And I would say that to train a family medicine physician, which is really the goal and the mission of the Oregon GME Consortium, is to begin family medicine and other primary care residencies. That's the hardest specialty to train for because you have to have faculty in family medicine, not only family medicine, but internal medicine, inpatient, outpatient, pediatrics, surgery, and all of the subspecialties. And so to train one physician, when you're looking at a three-year program, I would say it's probably upwards of 30 people to support that one person.
All of them working part-time, I assume,
on that, right.
On that project and other things on other projects.
Exactly.
Right. How about the demographics? I mean, my guess is that demographics of physicians, not too much different from the demographics of the rest of us, and a bunch of them are getting ready to retire. Is that a fair statement?
It is, actually. That is the part of the work of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee, is to understand supply and demand. And that's an ever-evolving and very dynamic process because the supply changes year to year to year. And we're sort of trying to look in a crystal ball and really understand what our needs are going to be years from now. And as you know, the beginning of the process, when Ryan began his medical school training this last year, it takes at least 7 years until he's out and a fully minted physician ready to practice medicine. And so the supply and the gaps are variable, but one of the considerations certainly is the aging workforce.
Right. So if you want to get these programs going, you need to do it soon, while the old guys are still available to work at least part-time to help with the training.
Exactly, and that's where the bulk of the collective sort of knowledge and experiences, right, the wisdom that we hope to impart and pass on to the next generation exists in the mind and the practices of what we call silverbacks, people who've been doing this for quite a while and understand what it takes to be successful in not only how to exist as a leader in a community as far as a physician goes, but also to care for the populace of that community. We need them. We rely on them to share their wisdom with the generation to come.
Thank you. I'm very familiar with the reality that even in Lane County, on the I-5 corridor, we have a serious shortage of family practice physicians. And so the idea that rural parts of the state would be in worse shape doesn't surprise me at all. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was going to ask you a question, but it's actually how many doctors would it take for us actually to catch up? And if, because being from Ontario, we have a choice. We've gone through the same exact challenges of trying to attract physicians to that town, which is only 43 minutes from Boise. So should we invest in better transportation to Boise? Or actually the newer facility is 22 minutes away in Nampa. Or should we continue to support this? The reason I'm asking how many you need is because maybe we'd be better off putting our money into a helicopter or speedier transport. I'm not joking. I really am not. I want to keep hospitals in my small towns, but it's getting harder and harder to get doctors to come to small towns, even ones that are close to large spots. So where should we best invest our money is what I'm really saying. And that also takes us to the question of why doctors, why not midwives? Because when you have $500,000 worth of debt, you're probably going to situate someplace where you get paid a lot of money, and mid-levels get paid less. Perhaps that's what rural communities' future is.
Sure. I can answer that. Okay. So let's see. The Robert Graham Center analyzed primary care physician demand and need back in 2010. And what they estimated was that Oregon will need an additional 1,174 primary care physicians by 2030. And that's only to meet the need that we know about right now. So to answer your question, I would say that healthcare delivery is a team sport, right? We not only need a quarterback, but we also need all of the supporting mechanism that surrounds that quarterback, or else nobody has the ability to catch the ball, right? So it is not just physicians that we need, which is the beauty of this bill, actually, is that it allows for not just physicians, but support for all of the other specialties amongst the healthcare team. Should you buy a helicopter? The somebody talked about the economic support of a community. One physician, it's estimated, generates on the tune of 5 to 6 jobs within that same community, as well as $1 million of additional revenue to that community. And so you could buy a helicopter or a mass transit to Nampa and to Boise. But I would say that the need of a community for a physician leader is huge. They bring so much more than just patient care to the community. They bring leadership and infrastructure and just that stability. And so I would say that I love Eastern Oregon, and one of the reasons why I'm part of the Oregon GME Consortium is because I think that we need to look at those counties in kind of, it's called frontier counties, to support you and them and the citizens of Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, follow. Thank you. Well, you already have a helicopter, and we get used to almost daily because, of course, the hospitals that we have don't enjoy all of the benefits of those in the larger metropolitan areas. I'm actually premising my question on Dr. Goldberg's previous head of OHA assertion that all the future medicine would be like spokes on a wheel, and that because of the sheer astounding progress in healthcare, that we will not be able to have all of those devices and expertise in small towns. So you'll have to have the transport. So we're working on that. At the same time, family practice docs are invaluable. My question though is, I think you answered it. We need, how many did you say, 12,000 close? Mm-hmm. And we're generating 150 a year. I'm just thinking we're not going to get there. Is that the correct conclusion to draw from what you've told us?
So I think the number was 1,174. But you're right. And so the time to begin is now, I would say. Otherwise, we're just that much further behind. And you are right, I would say, that the dynamics and the evolution of healthcare delivery is changing every single day. And that involves telemedicine and the fact that maybe every community doesn't have the ability or the infrastructure to have a level one trauma center, and nor do they need one if Boise is as close as it is to Ontario. So,
thank you. Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask several questions just as part of a dialogue. Just as background, I represent those rural counties, those frontier counties, so bless you for mentioning them and caring for them. What are we doing to reach out to rural Oregon's, in this case Eastern Oregon's, best and brightest high school students to let them know that healthcare is actually a real option for them? And I ask that question sharing with you that I've brought 5 kids through that system who were in law school, in PhD programs, et cetera, but medicine was never even an option they considered. And it was because it wasn't presented to them. Kids out of Heppner High School, out of Riverside High School in Boardman. Yeah. How do we do that?
Thank you again, Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith. Coming from a very, very small rural community of Cave Junction, Oregon, I think there was one family doctor in town, and I never got to see him. I think I saw him once for a sports physical. So for me as well, medicine was not an option for my career. I just thought it was too much school and didn't know if I had that academic horsepower. As I went through life, though, I discovered that I might. I went through former careers as an environmental scientist and a firefighter before I discovered helping people is what I really love to do, and serving my small hometown of Cave Junction and that surrounding community was where I wanted to spend my life and my career. And I found that serving in medicine was the best way to do that. Unfortunately, I didn't discover that in Cave Junction. I discovered that as I propelled myself out into the world. I traveled South America and discovered that urge to help people. And what I lacked in Cave Junction was that role model, those mentors that I could reach out to. The inaccessibility to healthcare professionals doesn't show you what you can do with your life or the opportunities that exist in healthcare and the dramatic impact that can have in a community such as mine. So I would say to address that need, let's place some healthcare professionals there. Let's put some training grounds in these smaller Oregon communities where the high school kids can have some interactions with those leaders, not just physicians, but the leaders of the community, which I think physicians really serve a vital role.
And Chair, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, there's OHSU has a program called Scholars for a Healthy Oregon that was started, I believe, 4 years ago. And I don't represent OHSU, so I don't know if they're here. They can speak for themselves. But the way that program is designed, it is to attract high school students and college students from rural Oregon to come and with full scholarships for the medical program, not just medical school, but also dental school, pharmacy school. It's to train rural providers and have them go back to rural Oregon or to in underserved Oregon. There's also proposals now to expand that scholarship program to programs like Comp Northwest, Pacific University, other programs that have rural training tracks, and try to do the same thing in those schools. So there is an effort to do that. It's relatively young. So those students are, I think the first of those students are just now in their finishing up medical school. Mm-hmm. Then they still got to do their residency and training. So it's the pipeline is long. But I think it's a smart way to kind of train your own.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Thank you. And again, I'm just thinking out loud, having a dialogue here. To me, it would seem as if without diluting down the academic requirements, there ought to be an application process where those students who meet the academic standards, meet the MCAT standards, meet all the other standards, but come from rural Oregon communities. The Oregonians that graduated from an Oregon rural high school ought to have some degree of preference in the hopes that they'll return back to the communities in which they came. Is that a possibility, or is there a discriminatory piece of that? What's the thought on that?
Absolutely. Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith. So to dovetail on what was just said with regard to that linkage program, we also have a linkage program. It's called the Lebanon Health Careers Ladder. It actually begins in the fourth grade, and so we are currently in our sixth year at Comp Northwest, and so the first students are now midway through high school, and it's a linkage program that if they began in the Lebanon Health Careers Ladder and move on through the process to any university, there's a linkage back to Comp Northwest to do exactly what you just said. And we exist in rural Oregon. We exist in a small town. And I agree with you that there should be knowing that, and the statistics have already been stated, that we know that over 60% of the time a person who trains in a residency of wherever it is going to maintain their practice within 50 miles of that residency. And the reasoning is everybody probably already figured this out, but residents are in their young life, right? They're married, they're just having kids, their kids are starting school, their roots are being set in that community, and so they're much more likely to stay in that community. And that's the reason that statistic increases to more than 70% if the person did medical school also in that state. And so if you can think about that rural kind of circle, closing that circle, that certainly makes sense, that if they stay here for medical school, they stay here for residency, they're going to go back to their rural family.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. A couple comments and then a question. I'm a little concerned about the talk of replacing old guys and silverbacks here as I hear the discussion. But other than that,
nobody here.
Like too young.
Yeah.
There was, and my second comment is, there was a proposal last session to target these funds to residencies that are created outside of the Portland metro area for the idea that you discussed that the chance of someone staying in those areas after training goes up markedly. But here's my question. Roughly 4,000 medical students aren't matching in residencies, at least this past year. What do they do?
You got my question. What happens to them?
What happens?
So, Chair Barnhart and Representative Bueller, thank you for that question. The shorter answer is a little bit of panic. And they come back into the line the next year. Sometimes they match outside of the actual match process, which is very, very regimented, and into an open slot. But the vast majority of that 4,000 do not match, and they have to come back in that next year. And so the numbers are ever increasing. Now, if you think about the actual number that were eligible was 41,000, and only 35,000 actually sort of checked all of the boxes in order to go forward with a match. So the number is actually bigger than it sounds. We need more residencies. That is the bottom line. If we had them here in Oregon, the chances that we're going to retain those physicians here and get away from the need for hospital systems to recruit and the cost that creates, that big burden on those hospital systems, it decreases.
Representative Bueller?
That's pretty remarkable and disturbing. So has there been any discussion about putting a moratorium on creating any more medical schools in the United States until we have more residency positions? It's really irresponsible for people to be essentially selling medical students' positions and all the debt that comes it, and not to mention all the effort to get through medical school with their career not progressing past getting out of graduate school.
Chairman Barnhart and Representative Bueller, thank you. I agree with you wholeheartedly. It is a bit cavalier and irresponsible to begin a medical school without the knowledge that the people that you're training will have a place to be for their next phase of training. And with regard to Comp Northwest, we're in our sixth year, and the hard work of creating the residency down in Corvallis at Samaritan Health Systems was done for the 7 or 8 years prior to us seating our first class. And so in the attempt to make certain that our graduates had a place to be, that's the work that we did. Mm-hmm. Now, across this nation, we have new medical schools and current medical schools that are increasing enrollment that are happening every single year, but the graduate medical education slots are not increasing for a number of different reasons, because the current residencies that already have the faculty in place, all of the infrastructure in place, with the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, where Medicare basically put a stop to furthering any current existing slots in existing training programs, it sort of put a stop to that. So the only new training program, the only training programs that are going to get any new Medicare dollars, Medicare being the underwriter of most graduate medical education training, is to begin a new program. And so that comes with a cost. And that's the importance of this bill, this House Bill 3085, is the fact that to begin that process, before boots are on the ground, before that first resident is there, there's 3 to 4 years of culture development, faculty development that has to happen in order to make sure that that training program is eventually going to be successful. And that there's a huge cost to that. Somebody said $7 million was the Eugene sort of price tag a couple of years back. Yeah, it's 1 to 3 million, depending on the number of residents you're planning to begin with. And that's not trivial. And when we talk about margin in healthcare, well, hospital systems, if you put a price tag of 1 to 3 million on it, the likelihood that a health system is going to say, yes, we want to do this and move forward is really low. And so 3085 would sort of bridge that gap of cost to desire and allow it to move forward.
Thank you so much. As usual, the last question often is the among the most important ones. I was wondering why the mismatch. And I think your answer to the last question really illustrates the point. We'll be able to blame it on the federal government and their rules, and we appreciate that very much. But that doesn't mean we don't have a problem we need to solve.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Kendall Mason, please.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, Vice Chair Bentz. My name is Kendall Mason, and I'm a political and policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. Thank you for letting me have a moment to speak in regards to House Bill 3085. I'm here today on behalf of both SEIU 503 as well as SEIU Local 49. Together, the two locals both represent over 40,000 workers who work in the continuum of care, and SEIU 503 represents over 20,000 home care workers and nursing home workers, while SEIU represents hospital and clinic workers throughout the state. Our unions see how training and upgrading of staff has long-term impact on the quality of care for patients and can improve the lives of working people. SEIU supports House Bill 3085 and wants to ensure that long-term care job classifications that do not need graduate medical education but may have a shortage or a cultural gap are included in the training funds available. Long-term care in Oregon is one of the fastest-growing sectors of work and need in the country. And according to APD's own analysis, in the next 15 years, the population of Oregonians over the age of 65 could nearly double, growing from just over 600,000 residents today to probably just under 1.2 million by 2030. And as a group, they have hardly any retirement savings. So this means that not only is our aging population growing rapidly, but they have less and less money to fall back on and will be dependent on Medicaid and Medicare-funded supports. And we are already looking at a workforce shortage in this industry. So there's really no need to wait till it gets worse. More training dollars into healthcare would allow for training and upgrading across industries and would help us fill the holes in many small rural hospitals and clinics. CNAs could become nurses. Pharmacy techs could become pharmacists. It's also a way to diversify an industry that badly needs more diversity. We strongly believe that the best way to keep people of various backgrounds not only in the industry but serving in rural communities is encouraging people to enter the profession in jobs with low barriers to entry and working on training and upgrading while people are actually working. We have seen by allowing workers to climb a career ladder through sponsored work and training that helps to change industry care standards for all patients for the better. It allows for healthcare providers to reflect the communities that they actually care for. There is currently work being done through the Oregon Home Care Commission and Local 503 to make sure that we are strategically developing a workforce that will be ready for the demand. And Local 49 is also investing in training within healthcare. They have bargaining agreements that often include payment for continuing education units, training, and licensing. And SEIU Local 49 has several joint employer training programs around the state, and they can point to success of not only increasing the capacity in a given profession, but also improved retention of healthcare workers. For example, last year, over 50 members participated in a training program at Kaiser, and one member, Julie, began at Kaiser as a housekeeper, and she's now a coder. So SEIU 49 and several major health systems currently have America's Promise Grant, and that grant is for $6 million over three years from the federal government to do training and upgrading to increase cultural competency and diversity in the workforce. So SEIU supports House Bill 3085 because we know by leveraging partnerships with labor unions, employers, and the state, there's even more potential to develop the 21st century workforce needed in Oregon. We can improve workers' lives and quality of care along the continuum of care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to get onto our next bill before very long, so if there's one or two very brief questions. Thank you. Very much appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3085 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2929. Representative Rayfield. I know you have to run, so we'll give you a couple of minutes before you head out.
Sounds good. All right. Staff need to go over the measure, or?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to give us a very, very brief one?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2929 had been somewhat amended from the original version. There were some things that were removed.
Give us the amended version, the version that we're dealing with today.
Sure, and so it's a little bit shortened, but there is a subtraction from personal income taxes of $100 for amounts of taxpayers pay in student loan interest, or the subtraction's above $2,500, an additional $2,500 subtraction up to $2,500 over and above the amount allowed by the federal government. The measure also establishes a refundable credit against personal income taxes for contributions to the Higher Education Savings Network account, so the 529 account. And there's also a tax credit for the amount of contributed to those accounts by employers of the taxpayer on behalf of their employees. And there are a number of just small kind of administrative concerns with the measure. Department of Revenue kind of alerted me to just some little technical edits that may be necessary to move forward, but none of it is would be an issue.
Let's talk about
amendments.
That later, and let's hear from Representative Rayfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Rayfield, House District 16, Corvallis, Philomath, and Oregon State University. What I first want to do is a premise for House Bill 2929 is really focused on student debt from a full spectrum, first incentivizing early saving all the way to the back end once somebody has incurred student debt to then how do we ease the burden of student debt and a lot of the ancillary problems that that causes. What I would first and foremost say is that this bill should be killed immediately if we don't have a revenue package. So just to be very frank with you, the only way that I would consider this is if we have new revenue coming to the state. But with that said, on that cheery note, let's go ahead and kind of dive a little bit into the problem of student debt. Student debt has been increasing over the years. It's actually doubled since, was it 1993, even when you're looking at numbers that are inflation adjusted. The problem with student debt, you can see it starts to trickle out into other areas of spending. So it used to be, this is an interesting graph, it used to be that you would go to college, you would get a good education, you'd come out, you'd have student debt, and you'd buy a home. What you're finding now is that the debt or the burden of student debt has increased. It is now flopped. Folks at age 30 are more likely that do not have student debt are now for the first time more likely to own a home than folks with student debt. And so what you find is that this continues out into a lot of different areas where you see decreased retirement savings, you see folks delayed starting their families, folks are defaulting on loans, decreased home ownership, and decreased consumer spending. So the idea of this bill is to kind of attack part of the end result of this by encouraging early savings, but also at the same time making it a little bit easier to give folks that breathing room once they do have the student debt, but also acknowledging that a lot of our student debt problem is the result of our chronic underfunding of higher education. So there are various components, and we've kind of talked a little bit about kind of the benefits of the early savings, but we'll dive into that a little bit further. Also, And I think this is where we really get into when we talk about the first component of the bill, which is early savings. And what you find is that in this graph here, if you have saved early, what really demonstrates how much money that you actually pay off on your student loan over a longer period of time, the increased cost there. But what I want to do is we can get into the actual components of the bill and have Tony walk you through those.
So for the record, my name is Tony Lapiz, staff for Representative Rayfield. The first set of components for House Bill 2929 is incentivizing early savings, so really trying to prioritize folks that would be otherwise non-traditional savers, giving them an incentive to save, and that leading into greater academic performance and higher likelihood of those folks actually going to attend a higher education university. So looking at the four pieces here, first being a $100 refundable tax credit for individuals. This is capped for individual filers at $25,000, joint filers at $50,000. So really trying to focus on folks that are on the lower SES spectrum. Second, a $100 tax credit for employers, trying to do a non-traditional way of putting into a 529 plan of having an employer pay into one of their employees' funds. Thirdly, being to change the way that we cap contributions for 529 plans and changing that from a per filer basis to a per beneficiary so that you can save for more of your kids rather than just for one. And lastly, being to not include the amount of money that you have in a 529 plan into the criterion and assets of determining whether you're eligible for state benefits.
Go ahead.
So next, looking at the back end, like Representative Rayfield mentioned, looking at how to best ease the burden of student debt once folks are exiting a higher education university, and doing this in a way that would allow the tax, the interest that you're paying on your student loans to be able to be deducted from your taxes and stack on top of the federal limit, which doesn't double once you're married, so that if you're claiming the federal rate or federal deduction, you're not able to increase that if you're a family. This would allow you to have that stack on top of the federal deduction. And again, this is limited based on income for individual filers of $65,000 or joint filers for $130,000, and then there's a partial deduction for folks earning $80,000 if you're single and $160,000 if you're filing jointly.
And so what we've done is these are various elements in the plan that we could, should we choose to invest money into this, change the sideboards on each one of these plans, whether they're amounts or whether we do income requirements, to then adjust to how much money the committee might want to invest into programs like these. Our preference would probably be to incentivize the early savings before moving on to the other side, but you can see through these slides there's various plans of how one might allocate money to the various elements within the bill. The one thing to keep in mind is that the one element where we exempt in people putting money into a 529 as income and also the money in a 529 as assets for calculation as in the determination of state eligibility benefits, that has a zero revenue or fiscal impact. So in the worst case scenario, if we didn't want to allocate money to this, we could basically amend out all of the components that cost money and just run the straight policy bill that is hidden within all of these various elements. And so with that, we'll keep it short and sweet.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. So if you took out the 529 eligibility or assets from eligibility, is it that it would have a zero fiscal or it's indeterminate?
You would have to remove all of the three components of the early incentivizing early savings. So the $100 refundable tax credit is an estimated revenue impact of about $5.8 million. Mm-hmm. And again, that is capped for income. There's a $100 tax credit for employers. That's estimated revenue impact is about $12.5 million. changing the limits for the contributions in the Oregon Savings College Network. That's probably one of the first things that I would decrease is $20 million. And then the component where we talk about eligibility of state services, that does not have a cost to it.
It doesn't have a revenue impact.
Yeah, okay, revenue impact, yeah.
Gotcha. And then it might still have a fiscal impact. It would be hard to figure out.
Exactly. Okay. And then the other component is the deduction, which I don't have on my list here. Gotcha. Can you remember what that was? At $7.3 million? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the last is a revenue impact about $7.3 million.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I appreciate you both coming and bringing this big problem to our attention. The high cost of college tuition is really got to be reined in. But concerning the difficulty in raising revenue, have you considered attacking this from the other side of the equation, the cost drivers? There's a very interesting dialogue with President Ed Ray before the House Education Committee, which said that, in his opinion, the main drivers of the increased tuition costs were not what you said. They weren't the fact that there has been a decrease in state support, but actually cost drivers such as increasing employee health costs, increasing pension costs from PERS and collective bargaining practices. Have you thought about those types of things that are driving up tuition?
Yeah, and Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, thank you for the question. I think you have to look at everything, but this bill is more addressed at the kind of the symptom of whatever the problem is. And even if today you were to, you know, solve the problem as Ed Ray has defined it, you would still have people that have this high student debt burden that would need to be addressed, as well as folks are still going to come into a system and take on debt, and you can save kind of system-wide, if you were thinking that way in terms of end user or student, by incentivizing early saving. So I think these can be a complement to whatever is going on in the other discussion within the Education Committee.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thanks again, Representative, for being here. I wasn't able to support this bill in higher ed when it came through, and I said at the time, fully endorse the concept because student debt is certainly a very important issue, but I think there's simpler ways to get there. And I guess I would point to, I think it's Senate Bill 1034 that my senator and Senator Courtney have sponsored, which is simply a straight subtraction of principal and interest on the federal obligation that would transfer onto our state taxes. And I'm concerned that the means testing that you're putting, that you have in here, I think would actually eliminate some of those folks who have most need of having the ability to purchase homes and cars and so forth that you point to. So I'd favor a straight, simple, if we're going to do this as a state, let's make it available to everybody. Because I think, obviously, as we just heard in the previous testimony, the debt that can be accumulated via folks in the medical profession and others is but those folks wouldn't have the ability under this bill to take advantage of that credit that you're talking about. So that's where I'm at. I mean, I'm in with you, down with you for the struggle here on this, but I think let's just simplify it across the board, let folks access it as they can, and let's get serious about that. So, but at the same point in time, keep in mind there are cost drivers that we put upon our institutions, and those are well known as well. So, thank you.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, thank you for the comment. The $2,500 tax deduction is actually mirrors the federal deduction and also the income caps that are placed on the federal deduction. And so that is, we just basically took the federal, moved it down because that hadn't been adjusted for inflation over time.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good seeing you, Representative. And I fully can support this legislation. And so thank you for bringing it forward. I struggle, though, with part of our conversation in the Capitol in that we talk about education as an expense rather than as an investment. I'm reading the facts here from the staff measure summary, and it says 68% of four-year institution graduates emerge with student loan debt, with the median being $30,100. So I pulled out my little calculator. And if I had to pay off my $30,100 at 6% interest for 10 years, it's going to have a total payment of $40,000. It's going to result in a payment of $334 a month. I got to tell you, though, if I came away with a degree from Portland State University and knowing that that helped pay for my housing and my food and my tuition, I think that's a great investment. I don't see that as a negative. I see that as, my goodness, I now have a degree from Portland State or Oregon State or the University of Oregon that for the next 45 years I'm going to be able to utilize to go make money. And so, again, I support this, but I wish Oregonians viewed the money they have to pay to go to school as an investment rather than as a burden. It's a blessing we have an opportunity to do this. And you know, let's put this in perspective. $334 a month would be your payment. That's less than a car payment. You go turn off your phone and go turn off your cable television and turn down the lights a little bit, and you can make this payment. And you've invested in yourself, and you now have a degree that you can market yourself for the next 40 years. So I support this. I appreciate where you're going with it. But I don't see this as an expense. I see it as an investment in oneself and in one's family and one's future. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith. And thank you so much. We're sorry to have kept you past the time you wanted to be here. I hope you're not too late for your next meeting.
You can always apologize to Representative Nathanson and Senator Devlin for me.
All right. I do that regularly issue of the big bill that you referred to at the beginning of your testimony.
Indeed.
Michael Parker, Marsha Kelly, please.
Thank you.
Treasury.
Afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Again, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 Savings Network. I'll be very brief. You heard Representative Rayfield and his staff give a good summary of the bill and what it does. I just wanted to provide some context for essentially what the income tax deductions in 529 really do for investors and for the state. We view that as an incentive, as a reason why people invest in the 529 plan. They can put their money anywhere they want. When they see the benefits that we offer in the 529 plan with the generous state tax deduction and the tax-free growth, that's what attracts them to this. So I just want to leave you with one number that we do look at quite a bit.
Now, is that related to this bill?
2929, yes.
All right.
It's the three provisions within 2929, the low-income tax credit for investing in a 529 plan, the employer tax credit for contributions, and then the per beneficiary deduction from per-return deduction.
Thank you. You just told me something I didn't realize about the bill. Please go ahead.
So I just want to leave you with a couple of numbers. Again, we really look at these deductions as an incentive and a reason why people are attracted to 529. So in the tax year 2014, there was about $104 million or so that was deducted from 529 accounts on the state side. That's about $10 million or so in an investment by the state. And we leveraged in contribution that year from Oregon residents, $283 million in contribution. So again, what we really strive to do is provide a program that people want to invest in that's going to benefit them going forward, but really leveraging the dollars that you give us, that you generously give us in that tax deduction. So that's really how we see this. The bigger the incentive, the more that we can drive contribution, the more we can keep that student debt piece down. That's our goal, keep that student debt piece down as much as we possibly can by having folks invest early and often. So with that, happy to take questions as we get done with the panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Again, a tax credit or a tax deduction. Since ballot measure 5 passed and we flipped the funding of state education, we've had 14 subtractions, 28 credits, and 6 other adjustments to income taxes passed by the legislature. And in property tax changes, we've had 27 deferrals, 11 partial deferrals, and 4 special assessments. I was pleased to hear Representative Rayfield say that lacking a revenue package, he would suggest that you do not go forward with any part of the bill. That's basically what I was planning on saying. We can't tax credit and tax incentivize our way out of a structural problem with Oregon's financing. And
if we don't do it, we keep on exacerbating the same thing. We don't have enough money for higher education, so it costs students more to go to school. I was very lucky. I came from a poor household. I worked hard in high school. I had activities, and my minister said, Marcia, apply to Willamette University. And I went to Willamette University, not because my family had money, very much not so. It was because I had a family who encouraged education. I was lucky. I was very lucky in a low-income household to have a mother who really believed in education. Unless we start working on our structural problems, that's not going to be the case for the majority of people. I think it's really nice, but $100 tax credit toward your loan, it's a symbol. It's not real help. But when you put together the numbers of tax credits, it really could help toward funding higher education instead, and meaning that you wouldn't have to borrow as much money to go to school. So I really appreciate Rep. Rayfield's discussion about don't move this forward unless we have a reform package.
Thank you. You'll be here tomorrow morning, I assume.
I will be here tomorrow morning. I have basically been in revenue, Chair Barnhart, since 2001.
Yes, you have. I'm well aware. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate it. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2929 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3041. And I don't have the list.
One person.
You have the list. Okay. One person. Jody Weiser. Is that right? Only one person?
It's Bill.
All right. Colleagues, while Jody's coming up, let me report to you that one of the things that I indicated to the proponents of the measure when we readopted this tax credit was that I wanted them to bring us a report on the efficacy of the tax credit, how it had been working, and if they proposed an increase in it, as they apparently have done, why that increase is necessary. So far, we haven't received any of that data. I will certainly await it as the rest of the session comes along. But I'm frankly surprised that we're not hearing today from the Oregon Food Bank or others that promised that they would bring forth that information. Jody, please.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. In answer to that question of yours, Philip Kennedy Wong said that this was not their bill.
It wasn't. Okay.
That they did not make this request.
Thank you. That really does deal with a misunderstanding on my part, and I appreciate
right.
it. Go ahead and give your testimony.
So the bill was brought back to life, and it was around, and then it went away, and it came back to life in 2014 as a 15% tax credit. So far we have information that we know it went from 90 farmers using it to 130 farmers using it. And so that's a significant increase, but we really don't have, there's no evidence that 15% isn't the right amount. It just doesn't make sense to make a jump to a different figure when there's no reason to do so. And we notice also that there are lots of other industries that donate food, like grocery stores and bakeries. There is no tax credit for their donations. And so it seems unusual to continue or expand this donation when we don't have a similar thing for other businesses that are basically doing the same thing. If you're going to make changes, the big differences are if you've got a field of tomatoes that you can't afford to harvest because the crop price is so low, you plow them in to the field, and they provide fertilizer, basically, unless there's an incentive to pick them and get them to users. So the food donation tax credit originally was for gleaning. It was when people came into your field and took some tomatoes out that they were doing that. Then it started being used when you had a crop and it was harvested, and you didn't have a great market for it. And so then rather than dump it, it makes way better sense to take it to the food bank. And it, of course, depends upon mileage and all sorts of things when you're going to do that as a business person. And so a really well-designed tax credit, it seems to me, would look at where is the product and who's providing what in order to determine what the benefit would be, not just it's the same price no matter what, because it could be that you were just at the farmer's market and you have some stuff that you didn't sell and you're taking it to the food bank rather than taking it to the dump. And in that case, it's saving you a dumping fee. It could be that you've got a request from the food bank to bring you truckloads of potatoes. And that's a very different situation, and that happens. And so I think that a tax credit that really looked at the specifics of the situation would make much better sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Jody? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Well, it's not really a question for Jody, but just a comment, and it's not my bill either. But yeah. I can't tell you that some of my pear and apple growers have participated in this program, but 15% is such a token amount. It's rare that it's going to be within the farmer's prerogative to try to pass on or to actually harvest a crop that they can't market, perhaps. Maybe they're hail damaged or whatever, they're perfectly still fine, but 15%, they're not going to do that. So that's where I think the 25%, I guess, what the bill has in it. Mm-hmm. It would probably dramatically increase, I think, and I'm only speaking for the fruit industry that I know about, but it would dramatically increase the volume that would be available to food banks. Mm-hmm. I don't know why those folks aren't here testifying, but I can just tell you from my own anecdotal evidence of talking to farmers, pretty rare that you're going to find anybody go through the hoops for 15% of wholesale. 25, I think you might find that more palatable, but that's just my own.
It would seem like it would make sense to talk to the 130 farmers that are using it, or a sample of them, and see. I mean, some of them were doing it before we had a tax credit.
Well,
you know, and so that's it depends on your whole situation a lot.
No, that's right. Oh. And thank you, Representative Johnson. I think you're onto something, frankly, that the information I was wanting to get was what does it cost? I think the questions that Ms. Weiser raises are good ones. A decision to make a contribution might very well come at a time when you've already spent all the money, in which case it doesn't cost you anything except the cost of gasoline to get it over there. On the other hand, it might be that there's crops in the field and you're going to have to pay somebody to pick them. And it would be useful, I think, to have some sense of what the costs are in order to have an idea of what that might incent. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, this brings back the many times debated point.
Yes.
And now I just would remind our witness that we should be looking at the cost to the state of the volume of food actually showing up on the shelves of these facilities, because it's incredibly low on a volume basis.
Yep.
The problem is, as we pointed out before, that when you compare the type of food that the farmers bring through the door to that which you can acquire with food stamps at retail and at enormous cost, but benefiting everybody in the food chain, and I mean the food chain, it's very difficult to get folks enthusiastic about offset. Too bad, because the astounding difference between retail at the grocery store and wholesale at the food bank is unbelievable. But when we do, I just texted the folks at the food bank and said, where are you? And we'll see if they don't appear with some of this volume measure, so that it's better understood what we're paying and what we're getting, which I think is your point.
Thank you.
Right.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to associate with my comments with the good representative from Hood River. My potato growers and my onion growers and my corn folks and my pea folks, it's awfully hard to get motivated over 15%. And I think a tremendous amount of food that could be taking care of some of our most vulnerable and needy goes to waste, and perhaps 25% is the number, but it may even be higher. And I would care to contend if we did a study on the economics of raising that tax credit versus the amount of savings it could result in. I think we'd see it's favorable.
Yeah. Another way of looking at it. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3041. Colleagues, 2 minutes. Committee's adjourned. See you tomorrow. 8:30 in the morning.